This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up, a diehard DIY mission to make a working toaster completely from scratch. Plus, America's original queen of celebrity scandal. Actress, activist, and Civil War pinup Ada Menken stole hearts from both Union and Confederate soldiers, and headlines from Abe Lincoln when the closest thing to Twitter was a telegraph. We'll also talk to the string rock quintet, Darling Side. But we begin today with what we learned when Wikipedia went dark. Reddit, Boing Boing, and other sites also blocked content to protest two bills under consideration by the legislature, SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act, and its center counterpart, PIPA. But withholding Wikipedia really brought the pain and demonstrated the burgeoning, attention-grabbing power of netizens and nerds. On the day of the blackout, we spoke to Brian Stelter, who reports on TV and digital media for the New York Times, about the internet community's newfound influence over American politics.
It took a while for the internet community to wake up to the issue that was before them. Media companies, old media companies like NBC and Viacom and Walt Disney and Time Warner, have been working for years to get stronger anti-piracy laws passed. These bills were before the Congress. They were in committee. It took a while, I think, for major internet leaders to figure out a strategy to fight back.
And other sites fighting back include Boing Boing, Mozilla WordPress, TwitPic, MoveOn.org. Over the weekend, you wrote a piece about a place that the debate over SOPA has been conspicuously absent on television networks. Why?
That's right. You know, this is something that was scarcely receiving coverage until recently, as of course happens with many laws in Congress. There are many bills that are proposed in Congress that work their way through the legislature that get relatively little attention until there's some sort of outburst, be it an impassioned congressional floor speech or, in this case, an online protest. What we're seeing, I think, in this case is the ability of the web, of leaders on the web, to coalesce around an issue and force people to pay attention. But for a while, it's true that television networks were not covering this very well. We weren't seeing a ton of coverage from the rest of the news media either. And, of course, it's worth noting that most of the parent companies of those networks support this bill. I was talking to an executive at one of the networks today who said, look, this is just a dense, complicated piece of legislation. It's not easy to tell a story about an anti-piracy law. Of course, what's happened with this blackout is a very visual story, and it makes the story very easy to tell.
Well, that's the corporate network story, but the slight coverage has given rise to some conspiracy theories about corporate interference and news coverage.
For sure.
Talk about what happened.
You know, it's a reminder, I think, that major media companies are not at all neutral about some topics, and piracy is one topic where they are very clearly opposed.
Well, MSNBC host Chris Hayes this weekend brought up the topic on his show. What happened?
I thought this was sort of fascinating because we had seen only one or two segments on all of cable news about SOPA, or this law called Stop Online Piracy Act, or SOPA for short. We had seen almost no coverage. So MSNBC, this host Chris Hayes, had the lawyer for NBC Universal, his parent company, on his show to talk about the law. And it became really an argument about what the facts are. They could not agree on what the bill actually says. You know, kind of a classic example of a bureaucracy mm-hmm. where you don't actually know what the legislation says. NBC says that, you know, the lawyer says a bill like this will not affect U.S. websites. Companies like Google say it will because they would have to police their search results and take out infringing illegal foreign websites. The reality is that all of us are only a few clicks away online from illegal content, TV shows, movies, et cetera. Most of us choose not to access that content, but some of us do. And that's what NBC is trying to stop. But to have a debate on MSNBC's own airwaves about it was pretty extraordinary. And I noticed again this morning on the Today Show, NBC had to point out that their parent company does support the legislation. So we're starting to see more coverage of it, and we're also starting to see more disclosure of those corporate interests.
Here, we have a clip here, actually, of the NBC corporate lawyer. His name is NBC Universal, rather, Richard Cotton. NBC, again, one of the major backers of the bills, and he was on with co-founder of Reddit, Alexis Ohanian. Here's what he had to say.
We're talking about websites that are wholesale, and I repeat the word, wholesale devoted to stealing content that is the production of our creative industries, distributing illegal counterfeit goods. These sites are exclusively that this legislation is devoted to are outside the United States. This legislation would not affect a single site in the United States, so to mention a U.S. site affected by this legislation is wrong. And it is totally wrong to say that a single post or a small amount of legitimate activity would be threatened by this legislation.
That's NBC Universal lawyer Richard Cotton, and he was speaking with MSNBC host Chris Hayes. Now, what kind of position does this put people like Chris Hayes in? You know, he's a content creator when his parent company is actually driving the effort.
That's right. It's a rare situation, but it happens from time to time in the media industry where media companies are driving the train on legislation, and it does make it difficult for an anchor or a reporter to cover that in a fair manner. First of all, it's important to disclose the relationship there. So Chris Hayes on his show talked about NBC's support for the bill and even pointed out that in the cafeteria and in the kitchens at NBC, there are all sorts of, you know, there's coffee mugs that remind you to support this bill. There's that kind of messaging going on inside these companies. What is significant about the Internet and about the blackout on some websites is that the Internet is a way around that sort of corporate media situation. So whether or not a network chooses to cover something these days may matter less because we can find the information elsewhere online.
President Obama came out officially against SOPA. Politico reports that senators, including Republican Scott Brown, are saying that they'll vote against it. So what has had the greater impact here, the president or, you know, the powers that be on the Internet? Everybody who depends on Wikipedia can't find Wikipedia.
Certainly the White House was reacting to some of this online uproar. So there was definitely a reaction to that, and I think people in the Internet community are saying, look at the power we have. It's an awakening of sorts to say, if we mobilize on an issue and we alert our readers and users to an issue, we can have an impact.
We're talking about the coordinated online protests against two bills up for debate in the U.S. House and Senate, SOPA and PIPA, respectively. They're pretty controversial anti-piracy legislation bills backed by some major media companies. Brian Stelter's with us. He's a TV and digital media reporter for The New York Times. Also with us is Brady Carlson. He's NHPR's All Things Considered host and host of our purveyor of all things awesome on the Internet. Brady, great to have you.
Great to be here, Virginia. And hi, Brian.
Brady, we were just talking about the emerging power of, shall we say, you know, the brainier forces in our culture, the web sector. We've seen a lot of movement politically on SOPA and PIPA since Wikipedia announced its protest. So what are we speaking to here? A new force in American politics? You know, the online force we should be watching more closely?
I don't think the tech and web sectors have really thought of themselves as political actors, certainly not in the traditional sense. And to echo what Brian was saying a moment ago, you know, there is no clear delineation between the two parties where tech sector could say, well, we're going to back this party versus the other one and really make that, become one of their key constituencies. But there is this groundswell of activity. It's very well organized and very quickly organized. This really started to build over the course of a couple of weeks. It's possible that rather than acting as sort of in reaction to bills like SOPA and PIPA, that this coalition is going to decide to be more proactive in the future to push for issues and policies. And we have seen some moves in that direction, at least in the United States. Facebook and Google both, I think, last year hired government liaisons. Actually, this is more formal already in Europe. There are political parties in, I think, Iceland and some of the Scandinavian countries that have put candidates on the ballot.
Like
under
the Pirate Party.
Exactly. And I think they've even elected a few lawmakers as well.
It's a great point that proactiveness may happen in the future here, because major media companies would kill a bill like this or try to kill a bill like this before we ever heard about it. The fact that this bill, you know, was in committee and being talked about for months before there was an online organized reaction speaks to how unorganized they've been until now.
Brian, I'm
curious. Internet leaders would also say that this speaks to the gulf that exists between what's happening on the Internet and where Congress is. In some of these early congressional hearings, it was evident that some of the congressional representatives did not know what the bill would actually do. That there was a lack of awareness about how the Internet functions, what the architecture, the structure of the Internet is. And I think it was a wake-up call to some people that were paying attention that day and thought, our representatives don't know how to set up laws in this area. It is so new and so complicated, and it's not something that our congressional leaders may be always comfortable with.
What's the conversation like inside of the newsroom at the New York Times? Conflicted? I mean, can you even tell us?
You know, I actually don't know myself if the Times has taken a position on the bill. I've been trying to find out today. I don't think we have. I think I would know if we had so that I could disclose it. I think we're covering it as a pretty major story because it is a coordinated online effort. I think it's intriguing to see if we see that same energy directed in other ways, because there are all sorts of strange bills that work their way through Congress that may or may not ever be voted on, and we usually don't hear about them, but the web is showing us there are new ways to hear about them if we want to.
That was Brian Stelter, New York Times reporter for TV and digital media. There's a link to his posts on the debate over SOPA and PIPA, and a link to the conversation we mentioned, moderated by MSNBC's Chris Hayes at wordofmathradio.org. Brady Carlson, NHPR's All Things Considered host and guide for our Here's What's Awesome segment on viral web trends, also joined us. There's a link to Brady's site, which includes his column, No Dough Wikipedia, at wordofmathradio.org. Coming up, one man's mission to build a toaster from scratch reveals what goes into products we take for granted. As One Word of Mouth continues in just a minute, this is NHPR.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, toaster.
Welcome back. You know the writer Douglas Adams. He wrote The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy books. Well, in one of those books, the hero, Arthur Dent, is stranded on a planet populated by primitive people. And he thinks to himself, I could show them the wristwatch, the internal combustion engine, the toaster. I'll be crowned their emperor. The trouble is that without other human beings around, Arthur Dent has no idea how to make any of those things. All he can make is a sandwich, after which he is elevated to the high office of sandwich maker. British designer Thomas Thwaites read that book as a young teen and wondered, what would I do if I crashed on a strange planet? The question stuck with him, along with the growing observation that we are disconnected from even basic technologies that help us lead our lives. Thomas settled on a quest to build a toaster from scratch. He documents the 9-month project in a new book called The Toaster Project. Thomas, good to have you on.
Hi, Virginia. Hi.
I never really thought I'd ask anyone this question, but what is a toaster made of?
Yeah, well, I think it's a good question to ask. I mean, at the beginning of this project, I thought I'd set myself, okay, I'm going to try and make a toaster. I went and bought a cheap electric toaster and took it apart because I thought, you know, I'll reverse engineer it. And like when I really took it apart, even down to kind of taking apart the components on the circuit board, you know, and laid it all out, there were kind of, you know, 400 or so individual bits which, you know, had all kind of come together into this object, which makes it marginally more convenient to toast a slice of bread in the morning.
Breville professional toasters help you get toast right every time. The lift and look feature lets you check your toast without interrupting the cycle. And a bit more is for, well, that little bit more. In fact, it will change the way you look at toast. And now,
because it's sort of a picture book and, you know, there it's got all your emails and backs and forths. You begin with deconstruction and I'm looking at it all laid out, all of these teeny little pieces and the bigger, more recognizable toaster pieces on one page.
Yeah. And you know, and that was kind of the question, really, you know, like all of this stuff, all of those components and all of the, you know, the kind of technological objects I can see in this studio, they're all basically made from metals and plastics. And those, you know, those materials have all just been dug out of the ground somewhere in the world. And then they've gone through this, you know, magical transformation into the kind of objects that we recognise. But I guess I was trying to kind of somehow bridge that gap for my own sort of personal curiosity in a way, because it just seemed astounding that, you know, all of these like highly complex things, they're basically just rock and sludge put together in extremely clever ways. Well, so I thought a toaster, you know, that can't be too hard kind of thing.
Well, and you found that it was. I mean, when you say that you made the toaster from scratch, that includes copper, nickel, steel, making your own molds for the plastic casing, for even the electric plugs, even learning how to smelt iron from ore. Where'd you learn to do that?
You mentioned like emails and stuff. Obviously, I sent, you know, I pestered quite a lot of people who are, you know,
plenty of pestering
know.
In here.
Yeah, yeah.
But I suppose it was very smart to ask for help.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that, I guess that's one of the, you know, one of the many benefits that, you know, the web brought to this project. You know, just kind of finding the email of, like, the chair of advanced mineral extraction at, you know, Rio Tinto, and just kind of sending an email saying, oh, I'm trying to make a toaster, I need to make some steel, how do I do it? And you know, and so then I went to this iron mine and dragged back, like, a suitcase of iron ore, and then... Yeah, I went to the library at a university and looked through the kind of textbooks on metallurgy. But they were all kind of fairly useless for my purposes because, you know, they were written for undergrads who were probably one day going to go and work for, like, Tata Steel or something. And, you know, so I had to kind of go further back in history for my information to kind of get to the same sort of, you know, a similar scale of kind of technology and sort of... So I ended up looking at a 16th century book to find out how to smelt my iron into kind of metal. But it didn't work. You know, I spent ages building this furnace and kind of shoveling in my iron ore and coke and stuff like that. And for various reasons, you know, which can maybe be summed up as arrogance on the part of my 21st century kind of self, it didn't work. Which was tragic. So then I think in the tradition of people wanting to save themselves a bit of manual labour, I looked around for kind of other source of information and ended up smelting my iron ore in my mum's microwave, which was just so much more convenient, you know. So, yeah, there were lots of kind of compromises on the way.
Well, in a lot of negotiations, I'm speaking with Thomas Thwaites. He's a British designer who took on pretty much the ultimate DIY project. He built a toaster from scratch, and his new book about it is called The Toaster Project. What I'm referring to, Thomas, is a hilarious bit in the book. There's actually a transcript of you calling up British Petroleum to get access to some crude oil for the toaster casing. Tell us a little bit about that conversation.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the defining feature of cheap consumer electrical goods is, you know, the smooth plastic case to cover that kind of mess of components inside. So I thought, I've got to have a plastic case. And plastic, you know, comes from oil. So I wanted to go to the source and get it myself. And I also, to be honest, really wanted to go in a helicopter. So I thought, okay,
to an oil rig.
Yeah, you know, they must have helicopters going out there all the time, so I, you know, give BP a call, and, you know, I spent kind of at least half an hour kind of on the phone to this guy in their PR office trying to convince them that it'd be fantastic for BP to fly me to an oil rig and let me have a jug of oil. Yeah, I mean, this was before the Deepwater Horizon disaster, so the PR office are obviously, you know, probably have a bit more to do these days, but even then they were kind of not willing to entertain the idea of letting me go and collect a jug of oil from one of their oil rigs. You know, it was a lot of fun trying to kind of bridge the kind of the gulf of scales, basically, between, you know, these kind of, you know, very much domestic scale things and the vast industry and processes that actually produce them. And, you know, and it was kind of trying to bring those sort of scales together, which was, which was kind of interesting.
Well, the toaster in the end cost you about $1,700 US, our conversion to make. I just checked Target's website and found one for $1,449, shiny, clean looking. I mean, the toaster on the cover of this book is, I'm sorry to say this, Thomas, but it's kind of a sorry sight.
Well, I mean, I think it has a very interesting aesthetic myself.
It looks like it's frosted, covered in frosting.
You know, it would definitely stand out. It would definitely stand out on the shelves. But yeah, exactly.
Like, I guess maybe it's not about how it looks.
No. I mean, it's certainly not. And I think we should all think a bit more about what's, you know, inside and what goes into these things rather than just kind of how shiny they are. But yeah, I mean, you know, that's not to say that I wanted to kind of dismiss the sort of the amazingness of this kind of global system which produces these things. But in my, you know, my choice of object that I was trying to make myself, I kind of also wanted to sort of maybe think a bit about what is actually necessary in, you know, using this amazing global system to, like, make this stuff, you know, to, you know, for a price that is kind of literally like a throwaway price. I mean, you know, you can pay more for a drink in some bars in London kind of thing.
Well, Thomas, we have just 30 seconds left, so you need to tell me quickly, how's it toast?
Yeah, it toasted for about 3 seconds and then the element melted itself. But, you know, no one died, which was the main thing.
Thomas Thwaites, designer and author of the new book called The Toaster Project. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Virginia.
There's more on the book and the project currently on exhibit at the Science Museum in London at wordofmouthradio.org. Now coming up, a story of celebrity scandal and sex in Victorian-era America. We'll get the scoop when Word of Mouth continues after the headlines from the BBC.
I don't know how, but my toaster's really smart. Do you guys have that? I'll take some bread and I'll put it in there and I'll toast it and it'll pop up and I'll be like, that's not toasted enough. And I'll go to push it back in, but my toaster's like, no, it's done. My toaster's a...
Welcome back. This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott with a story of celebrity circa 1860. News of the spectacular breakup between actress Ada Isaacs-Menken and the bare-knuckle boxing champ John Heenan splashed across the papers that year. Heenan accused his wife of bigamy. It was just one charge against the woman who was best known for bounding across the stage strapped to a horse in a skin-tight, flesh-colored costume. The so-called Naked Lady's fame continued when photos surfaced of her posing half-clad with author Alexandre Dumas. It was the Victorian version of the sex tape. Ada Menken smoked in public, was courted by Mark Twain and Dickens, stole headlines from Abe Lincoln's presidential campaign, was a pinup girl for Union and Confederate troops, defended homosexuals, and may well be the first American master at the art of exposure. Her storied life is the topic of a new book called A Dangerous Woman, The Lives, Loves, and Scandals of Ada Isaacs-Menken, America's Original Superstar, by Barbara and Michael Foster. And Michael Foster joins us now from the Argo Studios in New York City. Thanks so much for joining us, Michael.
Very welcome. I'm very happy to be here.
Quite a litany there, but just a slice of the short life of this woman who became Ada Isaacs-Menken. Even her birth name has been a matter of dispute. Tell us a little bit about her origins.
Well, actually, it's not so much a matter of dispute if you spend about 10 years researching her. She was born in New Orleans, Ada Bertha Theodore. Her mother was a woman of color. Her father was most likely Jewish. And Ada identified herself as Jewish and at one point was a disciple of Rabbi Wise, who began Reform Judaism in America. And she wrote articles defending Jewish rights and so forth. Later on, she became a defender of her gay friends. So she was very, very well ahead of her time in a lot of ways.
Well, having spent 10 years looking at her life, maybe you can judge for us. I mean, she was ambitious for a much bigger life from a very early age. Where do you think that spunk came from?
Oh, God knows. Where does it always come from? It's there. Behind Menken, though, the reason she could do this, she became huge on Broadway. She was the star of the Gold Rush in California and then London, Toast of London and Paris. The reason she could do all this was the infrastructure that arose around the time of the Civil War. And so what you had at that time was the camera, for one thing. You can't have celebrity and stardom without photographs. You had the two-penny newspapers, so anybody could afford one. So you could have a headline. You could have the sex scandal. And the sex scandal of the time was Ada and her boxing champion, John Heenan. Mm-hmm. So this was the first power couple, really. And again, you had the cheap newspaper, you had photography, the Telegraph, which was the Twitter of its time. Mm. She was so popular during the Civil War in the U.S. and around then, they had to have advanced seating. Advanced seating in theaters was never done before. And another very interesting part of her life story is she was torn between North and South. She was a child of the South, of New Orleans, and yet, being partly black, she certainly couldn't identify with the South. So she oscillated. And look, what are we facing right now but a divided nation? It's some of the issues of the Civil War have never been settled, and they are back to haunt us right now.
She is such a fascinating character, and as you're talking about, sort of revolutionary in many ways. But, you know, not famous just for being famous, as the saying goes. She was a tremendous actress, a writer, a poet, a painter. She became a trick rider and a terrific shot when she was growing up in Texas. But it is this association with famous men that sort of propelled her. You know, she had an early affair with Juan Zania, the Cuban poet who was later shot as a revolutionary. You mentioned John Heenan, Alexander Dumas. Now, do you think this was a calculation on her part? I mean, women didn't have power.
Yes, you
men
bet it
did.
Was. No, sure it was to some degree calculated, although she really fell in love with Heenan before he became the world champ, and that was a tremendous disappointment. It was very typical that she had this tremendous career, you know, of fame and money. Another thing, she was the first star to really earn money, a percentage of the gate. But her love life was a disaster. Mm. It just seems to, you know, think of Liz Taylor, for example, or Marilyn Monroe, who really couldn't have existed without Mencken to begin with, the whole superstar idea. Think of their private lives. Disaster, you know? Mm. And it just seems to go along with the – that's the price you pay for the ride.
We're talking about the woman who was the progenitor of the Marilyn Monroes, Elizabeth Taylors, or Madonnas, Ada Isaacs Mencken, the woman credited as America's first celebrity. And her fame and her exploits reveal so much about the nation's character and desire in the Civil War era, and even foreshadow its preoccupation with fame today. Michael Foster is with us. He and his wife wrote a new biography of Mencken called A Dangerous Woman. So, you know, as you're talking about, she was the toast of London, Paris, California, inspiring Dickens. This is a woman who did not care about her reputation, or let's say seemed not to care. Was she a proto-feminist?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, she was a great friend, for example, of George Sand, the French author, and certainly feminist. Most of their correspondence is lost because it was done by telegraph back and forth in Paris. So another thing I wanted to bring out is she attracted the attention of really important men. She had a salon, and they all attended. Tennyson in England and, you know, even proper ones. And Mark Twain was very much attracted to her. He was a cub reporter in the gold rush in San Francisco, and he was both attracted and scared of her. And he wrote her up. If you don't mind, I'd like to read something
it's
about her.
Glittering her effect, description.
Her effect on San Francisco. This is Mark Twain when he was still Sam Clemens, a cub reporter. Quote, "A magnificent spectacle dazzled my vision. The whole constellation of the great Mencken came flaming out of the heavens and shed a glory abroad as it fell. I have used the term great Mencken because I regard it as a more modest expression than great bear, B-A-R-E.
Mm.
That, by the way, is the name of our website, The Great Bear. I couldn't resist the pun.
All right, we have about a minute left, so let's leave her with a triumphant vision. Give us a picture of Ada Mencken strapped in a flesh-colored costume, galloping upon the stage, playing a man. In a play called Mazeppa.
It was a role that only men had played. Mazeppa, princely role, heroic freedom fighter. In the final thing, she is tied to a horse and she's going up a 4-story stage mountain. It had always been done with a dummy. Nobody dared. Well, she risked her life every time in this very scantily clad outfit. Ada Mencken equaled sex and danger combined in a show on stage. Of course it was a sensation. It always is today, yesterday, and today.
Michael Foster, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Michael and Barbara Foster are authors of the new book, A Dangerous Woman, The Lives, Loves, and Scandals of Ada Isaacs Mencken, America's Original Superstar. There's more in the book at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow our rather tame version of exhibitionism and submit your own on our Facebook page or on Twitter. Rap mogul Jay-Z's pop star wife Beyoncé gave birth to a baby girl at Lenox Hill Hospital 2 weeks ago. The news quickly outpaced all other top stories on Twitter, helped along by the announcement of her name, Blue Ivy Carter. just the latest celebrity moniker to inspire a collective groan and a Twitter hashtag titled Names Better Than Blue Ivy. Rockstar kids named Apple, Moon Unit, and even God beg the question of how a strange name influences a person's life. Scientists at the Max Planck Research School recently published a study proposing that unfortunate names can lead to unfortunate lives. Asawin Subsang is an editorial fellow at Mother Jones Magazine, and he blogged about the study. Asawin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Virginia, thank you so much for having me.
Tell us a little more about the study. What was the theory being tested?
To start off, ostensibly, it's a study on how your parents' poor choice in baby name can help set things in motion to make your life one colossal train wreck. I mean, the researchers claim to have found possible links between a so-called negative name and how that could result in smoking habits, or it would affect your love life, or even treatment by teachers in the classroom. Mm. So basically, the headline is sort of geared to read that if your parents name you something like Amanda Hugginkiss or Hugh Gerald Rection or anything particularly severe like that, chances are you're destined to grow up to be a poorly educated, shy chain smoker with a sex life that leaves something to be desired. But if you look a little bit closer at the study, the research gets decidedly less compelling. You'll see that the studies were mainly geared toward online dating in European countries, and that stuff about education and stuff like that was just kind of thrown in there as token tidbits. So basically, it's a study telling you that if you have a certain name, your profile on like eHarmony or the German equivalent of eHarmony won't get clicked on by as many sexually active users.
Well, so there's a kind of intrinsic attractiveness to certain names. Something you write, we don't exactly need science to reveal for us. I mean, is this a no-brainer?
Let me give you one example. There's one experiment where the researchers tested their theory by sending out tens of thousands of emails without photos to German online daters. And to test the intrinsic attractiveness, they found that people with names like Alexander and Charlotte got a far, far higher response than someone like Kevin and Mandy. Now, this is where the researchers lost me, if they haven't already lost you. The definition of a negative name isn't exactly staked out. I mean, things would be clearer if there was a historical figure named like Kevin Hitler or Chairman Mandy Mao, but there isn't. And the study just focuses on first names and doesn't even touch on the bizarre, funny, or foreign-sounding names.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned foreign-sounding names because, you know, looking at the comments, you know, on this your article, everybody knows someone with an odd name or someone knows, you know, someone named Spatula or something like that. Now, doesn't this raise an important question that names have culture and context? Your name is Asawin Subsang. I mean, not exactly mainstream.
Right, right. Trust me, the irony was not lost on me at all that my very, very Thai name was attached to such a blog post. Maybe I wrote because I, you know, take the issue so personally. But going back to your point earlier, being named Muhammad in Michigan is probably going to yield you far different life experiences than being named Muhammad in Islamabad. I mean, surely. So definitely there's an anthropological angle that should be explored that wasn't really staked out in this study.
Yeah, I'm not so worried about the future of Blue Ivy Card, are you?
You got to give the researchers one thing. You got to give them credit for acknowledging the obvious point that a name doesn't spell doom for anybody. I mean, context always matters. If you're the son of Jay-Z and Beyonce, it doesn't matter what your name is. I mean, you're set for life. You could be named Jack D. Ripper. And you're going to be like a monstrous success in every aspect of life.
Well, Asawin, I really want to thank you for joining us and bringing us through those very important points.
Thank you very much for having me.
The most amazing feeling I feel. Words can't describe it, but the feeling for real. Baby, I paint the sky blue. My greatest creation was you.
Asawin Subsang is editorial fellow at the Washington Bureau of Mother Jones. For a link to his critique of the new study saying bad baby names ruin lives, you can click on over to wordofmouthradio.org. And if you're not convinced of Blue Ivy Carter's guaranteed success in life, despite her unusual name, consider this. Just hours after her birth, Papa Jay-Z rushed to the recording studio with a track of his newborn daughter cooing and crying. It was sampled on the new song called Glory. Blue Ivy Carter is credited on the song, already making history as the youngest person ever to appear on the Billboard charts, or any industry charts for that matter.
Everything that I pray for, God's gift, I wish I would have prayed more. God makes no mistakes, I made a few. Rough sledding here and there, but I made it through.
Coming up, we're going to speak to the rock star string quintet Darling Side. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
A younger, smarter, faster me. So a pinch of hove, a whole glass of bee.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott.
There was a time, how did we go about it, one step at a time? Now we're happy standing still. I love you still. Everything stays.
The string rock quintet Darlingside is based in New England, but its lineage includes California pop harmonies, Appalachian roots riffs, and classical arrangements, all shadowing that full-on American mongrel we call rock music. After earning high praise and an eager following for a self-produced EP, Darlingside is rolling out a new subscription album called Pilot Machine throughout 2012. We're listening to the song Still from the new album. Darlingside is playing tonight at Nectar's in Burlington, Vermont, and we welcome two-fifths of the band, Harris Passeltiner, who plays cello, guitar, bass, and sings. Harris, great to have you with us.
Thanks very much. Great to be here.
Also with us is Hopkinton homeboy Sam Kapala. He plays drums and sings. Sam, great to have you with us.
Thank you very much for having us.
Okay, I have to say, we were listening to that song this morning, and three of us were humming it in our little pod. It's got this kind of sticky melody, this tight vocal harmony. We thought of Beach Boys. Clever lyrics. Can I call you a pop band?
It's certainly one of the things that we're okay with. Yeah,
retro pop.
Okay, that's a better distinction. So, give us a little bit of background on the rest of the band.
We all met at Williams College, where we all went to school, and we moved to Northampton, Mass. Immediately after graduation, and kind of started doing our thing there and trying to get into the music community there and writing and rehearsing and recording and doing all of the things that bands do to try to get a start.
And there are others of you, Don Mitchell on guitar and vocals, Oyan Mukherjee on mandolin, violin, vocals, David Senft on vocals, bass guitar. And you're the cellist in the band, and I understand quite a distinctive cellist.
I guess reasonably distinct player.
but I'm hearing like first cello in the Chicago Youth Orchestra, distinctive.
I did play a lot of classical and especially focused on chamber music, piano trios, so formal chamber music. And other members of the band also have formal training in choral arrangement, jazz, Celtic, world musics, and playing on street corners.
So this is not just your pickup band with people who are like, oh, I can play a few chords. I'd love to hear more about the album. Now, this is a subscription model for the albums. You're releasing it in installments. So what's behind the model? I don't know which one of you wants to pick that up.
We decided when we first got into the studio together as a band that we wanted to have an album experience, which is nowadays lamented and seems to be lost with sort of the shifting music industry. And what we decided is that we wanted to combine a bunch of different media, like the digital and vinyl and CD release and videos, and sort of unroll all the different types of music in small fragments building up to the bulk of the album when we finally release it. So we thought it'd be fun to have sort of a six-month album experience where bonus tracks come out and we get to release these small bites. People can pass around through videos, web links, and sort of get on board for the experience, and then at the end still receive a full traditional album, also offered in high fidelity formats and vinyl, firing on all cylinders rather than looking for one niche.
I grew up listening to, you know, 45s, A-side and B-side, or albums, you know, first song, second side. You have to think about that kind of thing.
Exactly. What we wanted people to do is be able to take time out of their day and actually put the album on and enjoy the listening experience and really get into the music, and that's why we're offering it on vinyl as well.
And still, is that a digital freebie now too?
If, you know, from our website, darlingside.com, or from pilotmachines.com, we are offering that for free, and it'll also be the first track on the full album when that comes out.
Here's another one, Drowning Elvis. This is the next installment of Pilot Machines.
Thank you. dead in the water. Circles on the mooring each day. Murmuring loops across the bay. Where I used to walk the surface with you.
Harris Pasolini and Sam Capala are with us from the band Darling Side. The band is playing tonight at Nectar's in Burlington, Vermont, and is rolling out a new album called Pilot Machines, bit by bit, throughout the first half of 2012. It's a very haunting song there. I mean, I'm thinking any evocation of Elvis has a kind of resonance to it, but it also made me think of Jeff Buckley, you know, the singer-songwriter who drowned in Memphis.
He's an important touchstone in our music, definitely. His album Grace is actually a favorite of ours because of its dynamic range and cross-genre appeal. It's just, he'll change it up. One song will be a traditional folk song, and then the next one is an old English hymn, and then it'll be a hard rock song, and that kind of dynamic range is actually reflected on Pilot Machines, our upcoming album, and we do listen to him a lot because he especially crafts songs around a core melody. The melodic structure is self-standing and very powerful, and so we really appreciate his music in that sense.
So you actually recorded the album here in New England, in what, Western Mass? Or?
Western Mass.
In the house that we all lived in together. Uh-huh. We all, for our first 2 years, all lived in one house, and we recorded it in the bedrooms, in the basement. So it has that character, and it's right by the river. We could take breaks and go outside and swim and stuff.
Uh-huh. Rocks, you know.
It was really great.
But then, and then how do you work with the producer after that?
Well, we actually worked remotely, mixed it remotely by having FaceTime chats on the computer, and then ended up flying out to Los Angeles for the final week to mix and master it.
Well, what can still happen, though, is songs can still be broken on the radio, so we're going to break another track here.
Yeah, and this is actually the first time that this stuff has been played on the radio, so that it is pretty cool. It's sort of the world premiere.
I feel like I should, develop some kind of old-timey voice, you know, like... Coming at you with the new song from Darling Side is Blow the House Down. This is actually from the new album coming out in drips and drabs. Blow the House Down, let's hear it.
This one goes to market. This one makes a meal at home. This one has closets. While the have-nots down the way have none. So I go to the mountains. I go to the river. I pass.
Who is the darling of Darling Side? Is anyone willing to admit?
The darling of Darling Side.
Is there a darling?
I don't know if there's any one single Darling Side. I think the darling of Darling Side, excuse me. Yeah, we are unusual in that way. We don't really have a front man.
Mm-hmm.
We've got five guys.
Five
who
darlings.
Each, yeah, five darlings.
It's a very, very bandy band. It's sort of a total democracy.
And we can hear it in the harmonies. I really want to thank you guys so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Sam Capala, Harris Pasolini, Don Mitchell, Oyon Mukherjee, and David Senft are the band Darling Side. They're playing tonight at Nectar's in Burlington, Vermont, and rolling out a new album called Pilot Machines by subscription in the first month of 2012. You can find a link to the digital download of Still and get details on future shows at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow our decidedly un-rockstar status and conversations on Facebook and on Twitter. Thanks so much for taking the time to listen today, and enjoy the rest of your weekend, no matter how you choose to fill it. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Virginia Prescott, and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie, with oversight and direction from Abby Goldstein, NHPR's Vice President of Programming, and web support from Brady Carlson,
Courtney Kenyon.
Andrew Perellin gives technical support,
and Dan Colgan. Dan, the man, runs our board.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individual,
not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.
Really, anybody else.
For information about the show, to listen to past segments, post a comment, or read our blog,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
Or use the On Demand tab on the NHPR app.
app.
You can join our community of listeners on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
And you can follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.